From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
Today's a special show because it's a special time for me, just days before the 21st anniversary version of my first award-winning book, A Way to Garden, comes out in an all-new edition. My longtime friend and regular guest on the show, Ken Drews, is here to take the driver's seat and interview me today. But first, these messages.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books in gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com. Underwriting support from High Mowing Organic Seeds, the first independently owned farm-based seed company proudly serving organic gardeners and farmers with 100% organic and non-GMO vegetable, herb, and flower seeds. HighMowingSeeds.com/awaytogarden.
So I have to shut up now and turn the mic over to Ken Drews, an award-winning garden author and photographer of more books than I can count or apparently write myself. Hi, Ken, and take it away, as they used to say in showbiz.
Hello, and welcome to A Way to Garden. I'm your visiting host, Ken Drews. I'm the author of, as someone said, soon to be 20 books on gardening. And our special guest today is someone who is familiar to all listeners to the radio show and the podcast, and visitors to Margaret Roach's blog, A Way to Garden. It's Margaret Roach.
Thank you for inviting me, Ken.
Well, full disclosure, I've known Margaret for more years than either of us would like to say.
Do you have any idea how long it is? I don't know.
What decade is this?
Yeah.
Early 80s, late 70s, something like that.
No, I think it's 80s. Yeah. Okay, cool. Yeah,
I was six.
Yeah, right.
I think, didn't Grandma Marion introduce us or something like
know.
That?
I don't know.
Well, we have. I have some questions, and you got some listener/reader questions, and one of them is a question I have.
Oh.
And it's kind of funny. Yvette wrote, how long have you had your beautiful home, and how did you find it? And I remember what that house looked like when you first got it. Didn't look like it does now. You seem to have a very challenging area to garden. That's the truth. And Yvette says, I am curious about whether you thought about that when buying the house or just fell in love with the property.
You know, it's funny. I was giving a lecture last night, a lecture I've given a lot called The 365-Day Garden, Nonstop Plants. And it's kind of a love story history of my former long-distance romance with the place where I now live full-time and garden. You know, when I was a weekender and I only would be there 2 days a week, that's why I say long-distance romance. And now, you know, it's a full-time, seven-day-a-week romance. Anyway, and I think back to that, and I write about it, and I talk about it in the lecture, but I've also written about it a lot. So what attracted me, I think, was the wide-open spaces kind of thing, the ruralness of the place, and that it was surrounded by a 7,000-acre state park, so I didn't really have visible neighbors. You know, it was like this so different from, I know I was working in a skyscraper in New York City. I'd gone to college in New York City. I grew up in Queens. It was so different that it seduced me instantly for its bucolic, rural, you know what I mean? Farmy, like, you know, there's a dairy farm down the street, that kind of thing. So I think that's what did it. You're right. It was a total dump, Ken.
Well, like me, you didn't buy it for the house.
No.
We both have nice houses.
Yeah. And well, yours is much more beautiful than mine. But it was on a steep hillside. And it is a very tough site. And I think that's what Yvette is saying, very challenging, besides being a cold zone.
Cold, yeah.
Yeah, cold zone 5, you know, 5B now we are, formerly colder. So the hillside thing is tough. And I didn't realize, because I was more of a beginning gardener then, I didn't realize how complicated some aspects of gardening on a steep hillside were. But I was seduced by the state park and the open land and these big farm fields and the sky and the bucolic old, you know, it's an 1880s kind of a little farmhouse. I was seduced by the bigger aspect of the place. So Yeah.
Hmm. Well, I'm not going to get into how you got a basement, although that just crossed my mind since we renovated over the years. We are talking about your newly revised book. You sort of alluded to the fact that this is a new version of an older book. When was that first book published?
21 years ago this spring, so whatever that makes it. Is that 98 or something? Yeah, 98. Mm-hmm.
Well, that book was mostly about making your garden, making your now famous garden Copaic Falls, New York.
Yeah.
But this book is larger and more lavish and has lots of really nice photos and lots of helpful information like your charts. The charts seem really useful, especially to your fans who have more sun than I do.
Oh, you mean the seed sowing charts, like when to sow what? For all different zones. Yeah.
Of course, there's the wit and wisdom and your lovely writing. And like the other book, but I think even more, this book is a memoir as well as kind of a nonfiction guide. Did you turn to the old book to write this book? Is this sort of like an updated, or did you sort of start over?
Right. Well, when I suggested to Andrew Beckman, a former colleague from Martha Stewart Living, who's now the head of Timber Press, the garden publishing division of Workman Publishing, I said to Andrew, you know, it's going to be 20 years, it's going to be 21 years, you know. And he said, oh, I always loved that book. We should redo that book. So, you know, at first I think we both sort of thought, oh, you know, she'll just tweak it. But then I looked and I said, let's both look at it. And we had a phone meeting, you know, and we were both like, ooh, more than tweaking. because, you know, my how times have changed, as I say at the beginning of the book, and it really is different. I mean, what did we know about pollinator gardens then? You know, what did we know about really, I mean, even native plants were, I mean, you and I would visit New England Wildflower Society and places like that. But those were the exceptions, not the rule, those kinds of places, you know. So many subjects we didn't know about, so many plants that then were the it plant, you know, the desirable plant, and now are known to be invasives that we all need to get rid of, you know, that have crept all over our gardens, thugs. You know, lots has changed. So that was in the first pass, it was like, oh boy, X-ing out some stuff that just is not right anymore, either ethically or because of plant availability or aesthetically, or was just ill-informed based on 20 plus more years of knowledge. So that took out, let's say, 25% of the stuff. And then maybe there was a third equivalent to like another third again as long as the previous book, you know, is like stuff that I know about now and I'm excited about now that I'd never even heard of or tried then. You know, I hadn't had all the adventures, just like you, I'm sure. You know what I mean? You're propagating. I know you've been propagating forever, but you've propagated many more things and, you know, figured them out than you had 10 or 20 years ago. And, you know, so your knowledge has grown. My knowledge has grown. So there were subjects I wanted to add that I'm excited about, you know, about beneficial insects of different kinds. By that, I mean native ones, not ones you order by mail. And, you know, my thing for moths and birds and, you know, lots of things. So I would say it's probably one third the original stuff, but updated, one third new stuff, and one third, I think, is like more than a little updated, you know, like 50-50 updated, anyway, if that makes any sense. So it was a lot, and it's all new pictures, and it's, gosh, it's about twice as big.
Yeah.
It's heavy. It's big.
You're saying this, and I'm remembering when we thought a plant spreads. We thought that was a good thing.
Well, that's the thing, right? And I call them certified confidence boosters, and they are. They, you know, Monarda makes you feel good about yourself, but that's nice. You know, it spreads, but you have to know what to do next. And then if it turns out that it's an invasive plant, not just a very lusty, great native that's really suited to pollinator attraction or whatever, like Monarda, which you need to learn to manage in a mixed bed if you put it in a mixed bed, some of them you need to get rid of or never buy in the first place. So who knew?
Well, I think your garden and, well, maybe all gardens are kind of metaphors for life. And The sections of your book, you have conception and birth and youth, adulthood, senescence, death, and afterlife. It's funny, when I say senescence, a lot of people say, what is that? And I say, well, it's the opposite of pubescence.
Exactly. It's the winding down. It's when you're not making all kinds of new cells and growing up. It's when you're kind of at the stage of life, if I dare say, that you and I are at, where, you know, there's more days behind us than in front of us. We're kind of falling apart a little bit around the edges. Cell growth has slowed. You know, it's kind of a medical biology kind of a term. So each section in the book, just like in the original book, and just like I've always thought of the garden, again and again, and when I lecture, I talk about this too, is anthropomorphized. The season of the year in the garden is anthropomorphized to be likened to the seasons in my own life, from conception to death and afterlife, as you say, because I see the garden and the gardener as really one organism with two parts, you know, working together. Yeah.
I'm still thinking about the spreading. What's the worst plant you ever planted intentionally? Can you think of it?
Oh, it's an easy question. It's also the most popular story I've ever done on awaytogarden.com. Petunia cordata, the chameleon plant, and it's still for sale, and I can't believe it, and you'll never get rid of it. You know, it's a nightmare. Yeah.
Mine is a native plant that's actually threatened in Massachusetts, Anemone canadense.
Oh.
And I was warned not to plant it, and I did, and it will definitely outlive me. It'll be here forever.
Yes, and it's adorable. So it's a beautiful thing, but it's
surprising.
Good in nature because it can do its thing in wide open spaces. But no, it's not a good companion, and that's why I said about the Monarda. A lot of the bee balms are not a good companion for other. Do you know what I mean? For neighbors, they overtake their neighbors.
They do for you. what you need is more shade.
I know.
And then they'd be little spindly things that
the
prey will
true.
Come back.
So.
There's so many things that we've planted over the years. You know, like they say they're perennials, but I think they're annuals. A lot of the woody plants in my garden are alive and have been here a long time. But when I look at pictures from 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, and the garden looks great, but those plants aren't here anymore.
I know.
They're just gone. It's almost like nothing lasts forever. What's your worst or saddest loss? Can you think of something that you bought and died? Or maybe something that you bought, died again, planted
again?
Yeah,
I mean, the woody plant that sometimes I'll see it mentioned somewhere. I don't have many roses. I have the blue-leafed rose, glauca, or rubrifolia, whatever it's called these days, rosa glauca or rubrifolia. I have a few of those because I like the foliage. But I had a rose called Veilchenblau.
Oh, purpley.
Yeah, it's like a
violet.
Yeah, it's a really unusual color. And I loved that thing. But the bed that it was in is now a patio. So it was a sacrificial, you know what I mean? And I kept saying to myself, oh, I'm going to get another one, and I never did. There was nothing like that color. It was just an incredible color. So I still think about Veilchenblau. And then, I don't know, perennials. I guess early on I started growing various of the hardier euphorbias, the spurges, and not the super invasive, crazy ones, but some of them have now, talking of shade, like you're saying, the garden has gotten older and bigger, the woody plants have made more shade, and some of my favorite euphorbias, palustris, euphorbia palustris, euphorbia griffithii dixter, and a number of other ones, they just have gotten too much shade to really be, not that they need to be in baking sun, but do you know what I mean? They're just not as happy as they once were, and I need to give them more space, and a couple of them I've lost. So I used to love that gold, that chartreusey gold, you know what I mean, that color. Then silver plants.
Get some of these, silver plants.
Well, I failed.
We had a question about a silver plant.
Oh.
From Tracy, who said, everyone says lavender is easy to grow. I'm in zone 5, and I can't seem to overwinter lavender. Any hints?
Well, I can tell Tracy how to kill it if she needs more help with that. You know, I have a moist soil. You know, I'm on a downhill. I'm on a slope of a big hill, and I have a very organic soil that has a lot of, you know, it holds moisture well. I don't have dry spots. I even have some places that are poor drainage. So including lavender, the silver-leafed plants are not my specialty, although I was very attracted to them early on in the garden. And remember, like, ordering everything Bellota, B-A-L-L-O-T-T-A, I think, Bellota and who knows what else from Wellsweep Herb Farm, which is still in existence over by you in New Jersey. And trying all these things and coddling them and whatever. And I think the key with lavender is you've got to get the species variety that are the most matched to your situation. And I don't know enough about lavender. I mean, I'd call Wellsweep Herb Farm. Let's make it a commercial for Wellsweep. Mm-hmm. I'd call them and say, because they're in what, zone 6? I'd say, hey, which one is going to do the best for me? I'd want to talk to an herb specialist to answer that question.
Drainage.
Yeah, exactly. Drainage.
Especially in the winter. Drainage.
Exactly. Yeah.
Let's see. Joan Marie asked, this is pretty funny, I'd like to know about your editing process in your gardens. What are the factors to remove plants? You know, how often do you edit? Once a year? That's a funny question, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's self-editing.
And the hardest thing to learn as a gardener is to edit, I think. You know, our friend Marco Stufano, formerly of Wave Hill, the public garden in Riverdale section of the Bronx, he says, bury your dead and fast. And by that, he means if you have stuff that's not really doing so well, like an underperformer, it's kind of, you know, looking a little nasty. Like, don't just nurse it along and have a spot where there's this pathetic thing sitting there. You know, throw it away, compost it, try something different. And he doesn't think twice about that, about editing. But he's a master, you know, a master designer and a master plants person. I want to nurse everybody along. I don't want to lose. You know what I mean. You know, I don't want to thin
it's
the carrots.
Especially that when they're having a slow 10-year death.
Yeah. So as far as editing, what I find works best for me, if I walk around the place, and it's very old now, the garden is more than 30 years old, and so things have really changed, and a lot of things have come and gone, as we've been talking about. If I walk around the whole place and think, oh, my God, I've got to fix this, I've got to fix that, I've got to focus on one area each year and say, hey, let's shape this back up, right? You know, one big bed or one, and my beds are really big, so that's a project. If I wander all over and try to edit, not so easy. Some plants need editing every year. Like early on, I planted Pedicites ex hybridus, big leafed thing that runs sideways 100 miles an hour. I still have the plant, but I have to dig a trench around it every year. So that's editing, right? The Monarda that I keep mentioning, if I still had bee balm, I would want to edit around its perimeter to keep it in check every year. So some plants need that every year.
Well, that's funny because that's almost like picking lettuce. You know, you're controlling, you're harvesting. It's not like, I mean, Marco would, you know, oh, this tree, throw it out.
Yes. Yes.
Not me.
Yeah.
It's in the wrong place. Well, just plant stuff around it.
Yeah.
So it looks like it's right. And,
yeah.
And suffer for years. Yeah. You mentioned Wave Hill, and so that makes me think, what gardens have inspired you the most that you've seen? And do you have a favorite garden ever besides your own?
Ooh. Well, I suppose inspired me as in gave me confidence to make my garden on a steep hillside was
and
this,
turned you on. That's
yeah,
two questions.
Yeah, it was Powys Castle in Wales, of all the crazy things, which is a castle with giant terraces leading up to it from the valley floor. So nothing like my place, my little hillside and my dumpy little house. But it said to me, if this can have become on this steep site, can have become one of the world's most visited gardens over so many years, I think it's a National Trust garden, I can certainly, you know, garden on a hillside. So that was one. And I think the first time that I went to Great Dixter in England, I think that shook me up because it was in a lot of the books that I had read, it said what colors go together or don't go together, like there was some kind of implied rules or something. And Great Dixter was just this incredible abandon and daring. And I thought, wow, you can do whatever you want. You know, it's your garden. Go ahead. Do you know what I mean? I felt an excitement seeing plants put together in ways that weren't in the books. I mean, of course, they were in Christopher Lloyd's books, who made that garden. His mother had made it, and then he continued it. But do you know what I mean? That weren't in the other books that I was reading back at home. So those would be two highlights I recommend seeing in one's lifetime.
Remember how we used to shop all the time and look for the latest plant, and there were lots of nurseries then, and we would shop and shop and shop.
All gone. All gone.
And now I find that I hardly shop at all. It would just, and I feel guilty because I wanted to support all these places, but there's no room. And as I'm thinking of it, it's sort of like the garden has a peak and then it's a slide.
Yes.
And you're planting and growing and planting, and then you're pruning and controlling, like the pedicytes. And
right.
Do you know when that happened? Was there kind of a period or a time when
the senescence began?
Yeah, right. I guess so.
I think the first 15 years are uphill, and then I think after you get somewhere between 15 and 20, you start to have where, you know, some of the shrubs overtake each other and something's got to give. You've got to take some out in the big borders, and you'll have one too many ice storms and lose some of your woody plants, some of your backbone, your architecture. I mean, and a lot of the perennials, as you said, are really more like sort of long-lived annuals or short, the so-called, quote, short-lived perennials. You know, they disappear on you. Yeah. We have about 3 minutes, by the way. I can see the clock, but you can't, even though you're in charge.
Yeah, I'm in charge.
Yeah.
So I mentioned that we don't shop so much.
No.
But is there a plant you're wishing you had, or is there something you're thinking about getting, or something you wish you had bought 10 years ago? Well, there's lots of that. What's on your bucket list? Any shopping plant on your bucket list?
I'm more and more, maybe because I'm overwhelmed at the prospect as I get older and older of being able to maintain even what I have and trying to simplify the areas that I have. I'm more and more attracted to things that I can put in a pot and enjoy for the season and then put in the basement and store. And you and I both do that. We both have a lot of euchomis. And I've been interested in the aroids, like the Amorphophallus and the Ceromatums and, you know, the voodoo lilies and stuff. I'm interested in kind of these oddball, very plants with lots of character, but that I can, again, have in a pot but have for many years and store in my basement. So that's the thing that I keep. I find when the catalogs do come, I look in that section, I don't know why, that's one of the things that I'm still buying is euchomis.
So you like the stinky plants, and maybe we can think of something like the schlep plants, because you got to move them.
Yeah.
As long as we can still move them.
Yeah.
You have a hand truck, I guess.
I do, yes.
Wow, there's so many things I want to ask you. I know we don't have but just a few minutes. We're talking about everything, life and death. And can you think of the saddest loss?
I can't remember which year it was. It was in the last 6 or 7 or 8 years. It wasn't too long ago. We had a horrendous ice storm, you know, a series of winter events, including a big ice storm. And a number of shrubs were erased. They were just broken beyond being able to be rehabilitated with pruning. In my head right now, I can't even, as soon as we hang up, I know I'll remember all their names. But woody plants, I fear the loss of woody plants because it takes, like, I have this, you know, copper beech up on the hill that was 5 feet tall when I planted it, and now it's this massive creature. You know, I fear my Japanese umbrella pine. I fear the loss of woody plants more than anything else because they're such important companions, you know.
It's time. It equals time.
It's time. So.
And I guess speaking of time.
Speaking of time, Ken Drews, thank you very much for doing this. And thank you very much for your kind words about the book also before. Thank you.
And what's the name of the book?
A Way to Garden, of course.
Yeah, look for it. Right now.
Right now. Go look for it. All right. Well, thank you. I'll talk to you soon, okay?
Good.
Underwriting support from High Mowing Organic Seeds, the first independently owned farm-based seed company proudly serving organic gardeners and farmers with 100% organic and non-GMO vegetable, herb, and flower seeds. HighMowingSeeds.com/awaytogarden. Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books in gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com.
And I hope I'll talk to all the rest of you soon again, too. Don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version on Stitcher or iTunes or Spotify. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or on Facebook and Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.